Peggy is already back too.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to convene the March 27, 2017 meeting of the Natural Resources Subcommittee of the Joint Ways and Means. We have this afternoon a public hearing, the first session on House Bill 5010-5010, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'm going to open that public hearing. Do we have any background on this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you do. The LFO background material is posted on OLIS as usual. You also have the agency's presentation. They have a fairly lengthy presentation to get through in a couple days, so I think we'll just let them start working their way through that.
Very good. Thank you. And I'd like to call forward the department, please. Good afternoon to each of you. Welcome to our subcommittee.
Good afternoon.
We're going to be spending a few hours together here.
We will try to get through as many of these slides. We have, I think, about 100 slides in our deck between the 2 days, though. So I think we'll be all right, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm the director at the Department of Fish and Wildlife. With me today, I have Cameron Smith to my left. Cameron is the acting deputy director for administration. And then, of course, I have Kathy Conley from Budget and Management Office at Department of Administrative Services. So with that, we're going to jump right in here, Mr. Co-Chair, and go through our story. The Department of Fish and Wildlife, we have, of course, a whole book of statutes that guide our work. We have two fundamental, really foundational statutes, the Oregon Wildlife Policy, which is ORS 496012, as well as the Food Fish Management Policy, ORS 506.109. Both of these are foundational statutes that really guide the Commission and the Department as we implement fisheries and wildlife management. Our mission, which is not in statute, but drives out of those two foundational statutes, our mission is to protect and enhance Oregon's fish and wildlife and their habitats for use and enjoyment by present and future generations. Just a few agency facts, and I'm going to go through these really quickly, but there's over 850 species of fish and wildlife in the state. Out of those 850 species, about 80 wildlife species and 105 fish species are actually hunted and fished for. The rest are essentially non-game wildlife. We have 18 endangered and 30 threatened species in the state. We do sell just under 700,000 angling licenses annually, as well as in excess of 300,000 hunting licenses annually in the state. And we have an estimated 1.4 million individuals who also participate in wildlife viewing activities. We annually release, and there's an error on this bullet, but we annually release 39 million salmon and steelhead smolts from our facilities, 5 million trout, and 1 million other species, which would include, for instance, kokanee. Fishing, hunting, and shell fishing and wildlife viewing are really important pieces of Oregon's economic engine and contribute in excess of $2.5 billion annually to the Oregon economy. The source of this infographic is from the Congressional Sportsman's Foundation and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, really just to highlight that retail sales, wages, and jobs are all important components of fishing, hunting, and wildlife viewing, with their impacts measured in the billions and certainly in the tens of thousands of jobs in the state. Similarly, about a little less than a decade ago, the department partnered with Travel Oregon to do a study of travel-related expenditures, and we did it based on counties across the state. So we have the resolution to look at county-level impacts of travel-related expenditures associated with fishing, hunting, and wildlife viewing. And you'll see in many counties those expenditures, those travel-related expenditures, exceed 40% of the travel-related expenditures in the county. I want to talk a little bit about agency organization. Of course, the governor, we're an executive branch agency. The governor appoints a commission, 7-member commission, all volunteers. The commission hires a director. That would be me. And then under within the agency, we have 2 primary deputies, one for administration that handles essentially the business side of the agency, and a deputy for program, which handles the fish and wildlife policy-related programs. And then lastly, you'll see the dashed blue line off to the state police. We, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, is one of 2 agencies across the country that does not have enforcement within the agency. We do contract our enforcement out through to the Oregon State Police to conduct fish and wildlife enforcement across the state. Alaska is the other state that has a similar model. We'll talk a little bit more about our state police at a very high level, our state police enforcement efforts. The department does operate 93 facilities around the state. I think we have facilities in almost every county. There might be 1 or 2 counties without a Department of Fish and Wildlife facility. We operate 32 fish hatcheries, 16 wildlife management areas, and then a number of district and regional offices across the state. I want to talk a little bit as we set the stage here. In order for us to kind of understand where we are now, I want to talk a little bit about where we've been. And historically, over the last 2 decades, we've essentially set our fees on a 6-year cycle. That is, fees were adjusted and intended to last the agency for 6 years. That did occur in 2009. We had a fee bill, adjusted the agency fees in 2009, with the expectation that those revenues would sustain department programs for 6 years. That would be through 2015. We did fulfill that commitment. However, we struggled, particularly in the latter 2 years of that time frame, with cash flow issues. And cash flow for us as an agency is really important in that, as you'll see later, a large proportion of our work is federally funded work that is we're reimbursed for that work after the agency completes the work, which means we have to float or carry those federally funded programs until we receive reimbursement. So we did meet that commitment through 2015 without a fee increase. However, we did have, as I mentioned, cash flow issues and there was a variety of factors that contributed to that. We had lower than projected interest earnings. If you all remember, as an agency that carries an ending balance, interest earnings can be an important part of our portfolio. If you all remember what happened beginning in about 2009 with interest rates, essentially our interest earnings went from in the $1 million per year area to essentially in the tens of thousands of dollars range. So really lost interest earnings due to the economic downturn. We also had, during the economic downturn, we also had lower than projected non-resident participation, which contributed to lower fee-based revenues. And then lastly, during the economic downturn, general fund was generally moved away from the agency and backfilled with license dollars. So there was some fund shifting that went on. And all 3 of those really contributed to our cash flow issues over the last several years. I mentioned already a little bit of this, but fishing and hunting participation is a key budget driver for the agency. Essentially, participation has largely been flat over the last decade. If you look at it on a per capita basis, though, it's continuing to decline. I talked a little bit about general fund earlier. General fund trends over the last 3 decades have generally been declining.
Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you back up one on the non-resident revenues, lower than expected? Did we reach out to the people that had previously put in for tags and licenses and ask them why?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, and Representative Esquivel, we did do some customer service surveying, and there's a combination of factors in play. The non-resident fee increase in 2009 was actually even larger than the department recommended. So we had a large fee increase in 2009 that certainly impacted some non-resident participation. But then we just saw reduced travel with the economic downturn in the 2009 era. We saw reduced travel, and folks were not traveling as much to, you know, out of state, to other states to participate in activities.
Thank you.
Yep. So along with these generally flat or declining per capita participation rates and generally over the last three decades declining general fund support for agency programs, we've also seen increased demands for services. We have multiple layers of federal work that we're doing related to ESA listed species, many, many more management complexities with things, new species on the landscape, for instance, gray wolves in Oregon. And so while the revenue and the funding has been generally flat or declining, the work and expectation for work has been increasing. And I want to talk, since we're talking about the funding model, just very briefly about the current funding model. Some have said that the current funding model is broken. I don't think the current funding model is broken. The current funding model is one of user pays, and it was actually Carl Shoemaker, who was a newspaper publisher in Roseburg in, I believe, the 1920s, and later the Fish and Game Commissioner in Oregon, left that post to go to Washington, D.C., and essentially was the mastermind, if you will, behind the Pittman-Robertson Act, which really brought us into the modern era of user pay for fish and wildlife management. Some have said the model's broken. I don't believe that the model's broken. We believe that we're just asking the model to do too much. The model was designed to manage fish and wildlife species that are hunted, not manage all the other species and all the other impacts that occur across the landscape. I mentioned the changing demands. We have, as I mentioned, based on survey results, about 1.4 million individuals that view wildlife across the state annually. They provide significant economic benefit in terms of their expenditures associated with those activities, but the department really receives very little revenue associated with those activities. I talked a little bit about the commitments that we have at the federal level as it relates to implementing the Endangered Species Act and other activities. And through the work of this body, through legislative action in 2015, one of the important bills that passed was House Bill 3315, which beginning in 2019 gives the department the ability to recover costs associated with our work on behalf of other executive branch agencies when we participate in their fee regulatory fee programs. And then also out of the last legislative session, and we're going to talk a little bit more about some of our work in standing that program up here in a little bit under Cameron's presentation, and then also the legislature adopted House Bill 2402, which created an alternative funding task force, which the department has been engaged in over the last year and a half. So as we prepared again for the 15-17 budget, as we looked at our situation 2 years ago, we projected essentially a $32 million gap between current service level budget and revenues. This gap was based on a number of assumptions. First of all, our intent to restore working capital, and we're going to talk a little bit about our working capital and where we were and where we are now in a few minutes, but we wanted to restore working capital. We were assuming that we would fully fund programs, so if the legislature approved a budget with the programs in place, we assumed we were going to fully fund those programs without taking management actions to withhold or hold positions vacant to make square pegs, if you will, fit in round holes later. We assumed increased costs for inflation. We assumed no additional revenue from license sales or other sources. That is to say, we did not project that we would be able to increase participation rates, and we in our planning expected and intended to fully fund the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division. And also, lastly, that this would again occur based on a six-year planning horizon. As we stepped back and looked at that funding gap and planned for the future, we really took what amounted to a three-pronged approach, which was a combination of building efficiencies into the agency as well as reducing positions, shifting to alternative revenue where appropriate. So we asked for general fund for some positions in the last fee cycle or in the last budget cycle. And then the third component of that three-legged stool was to adjust our fees. When we talk about position reductions, let me jump back. I don't want to. When we talk about position reductions, we did eliminate or reduce 46 positions in our last, for our current biennium, the biennium we're in right now. Those were 46 positions, were all essentially entirely license-funded positions. So we're really trying to become efficient. We were able to do that through a lot of our process improvement work and eliminated a number of administrative positions. And I think for the most part, if you go across the state, the customers did not see any loss of service associated with that efficiency that we built in. I want to show you the cash flow picture here. We have, within our budget, we have two important sources or types of funding in our budget when we carry a balance. So, of course, we have dedicated and obligated funds, which are shown here in the red line. Those are statutorily obligated for certain purposes. For instance, the access and habitat funds, which are dedicated for access and habitat work, are part of that that red line ending balance. And then the blue line, which is our license fund ending balance. And these are the dollars that we use for working capital as we conduct primarily federal contract or work on federal contracts and then seek reimbursements. And you'll see that through the time frame there in mid to late 2013, we were essentially, this is each month after payroll, we were essentially in some months at zero balance. I think our lowest point was $1.87 after payroll. We had $1.87 in our account 1 month, which is not a good place to be, as you might imagine, which is why we took that approach, the three-pronged approach, reducing program, finding alternative revenue and increasing fees. And over the last basically 36 months, through a lot of hard work and through a number of actions, you'll see that we have built that monthly cash balance up, the blue line there, pretty much solidly in the $25 million range, which is higher than it's been certainly over the last decade. It's about 2 months of operating expenditures. Our monthly operating expenditures are about $13 million per month. So ideally, we would like to have 3 months of balance on hand, because we know that we're one federal government shut down or some other hiccup away from seeking a line of credit to make payroll, and we would like to avoid that. But nonetheless, we're in a much better position now with regard to our agency financials than we were a couple years ago. So I talked a little bit about the approach that we took in the 2015 session to our fees, and we did, as Representative Esquivel asked about earlier, we did extensive public survey work with our license holders to find out what approach worked best for them. And one of the things we heard from them to a pretty strong majority was they preferred fees to increase gradually over time, not to have one large increase, which was our prior model, which was one large increase that then lasted us out for 6 years. The customers said they really preferred more gradual increases, so we brought to you all a proposal that essentially phases those increases over the next 6 years, again on a six-year cycle. And this chart really is just to highlight the magnitude of the changes, and we were somewhat strategic in these. It's not reflected in this chart, but we actually lowered the cost of youth participation. We extended the low-cost youth license to all non-resident youth as well as resident youth, with the hope that we can recover some of our non-resident participants by given the fact that they can bring families to the state to fish or hunt at a much more affordable cost. And I just want to show a little bit license sales to date. So this is for our 2016 calendar year. Typically, when we raise fees, and this has been the case not just in Oregon, but really nationally, when we raise fees, we typically see a customer response, which is a decline in sales. And 2016 represents really the first year that we have not observed that. We actually, our new fees were effective January 1 of 2016. And when you look across the broad categories here, you'll see that while there are a few that had modest declines. The overall, across the board, overall, most of our products sold at a modestly higher rate than we expected. Most, I just want to highlight perhaps the most impressive, and that is right in the middle, the Pioneer license. The Pioneer license is available to individuals who are 65 years old or older, and they have to have been in the state for 50 years. That license was free for about the last 15 years, and it's our fastest growing demographic. Our sales in the Pioneer category, sales, if you will, delivery of free licenses, it was increasing essentially 10 to 16% annually. In the 2015 session and part of our current fee package, we brought to you a recommendation that we should charge $6 for a Pioneer license.
Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Who determined that we have to live here for 50 years? I mean, I've always been curious on that.
Yeah, Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, and Representative Esquivel, it's a great question. And I actually did some research on the Pioneer license. The Pioneer license has been around since the state first started selling hunting and fishing licenses in 1901. And in 1901, you got a free license as a pioneer if you were in the state prior to statehood. You had to be a true pioneer. A pioneer, literally, not just figuratively.
I have a pioneer license, but I wasn't here before we became a state. I wanted to put that on the record.
Are you sure?
Wait a minute here. Gotta work with me.
So it's evolved over the years. At some point, and I did not look at every step of its history, but at some point I'm sure it became apparent that no one that was living in the state could qualify for a Pioneer license, and I'm sure there was discussions here, and the legislature decided, okay, we're going to give it to people who have been here over 50 years.
Hmm. So, I was curious. I just because you go to other states, you get a Pioneer license if you've been there over 6 months and or over 62, I believe, or 65.
Sure. And Representative Esco, we do have a senior citizen license that is separate and aside from the Pioneer license. It's a discounted rate.
Senior citizen.
Hmm. Yeah, we do have. So our Pioneer license, we recommended in the last budget cycle that we charge $6 for the Pioneer license. Our real motivation in charging $6 is, as we talked about earlier, the Pittman-Robertson, the Sport Fish Restoration funds that come back to the state from federal excise taxes, they come to us based on a formula, and the formula includes the licenses sold. When we issue a free license, we do not qualify for the federal funds. So by charging the $6 was the lowest price that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said we could charge to leverage those federal funds. We came to you with the $6 recommendation. You supported that, and so we are now leveraging additional federal funds. But the point in my long discussion here is that if you look at the sales results, despite the fact that we went from free to $6, our sales still went up 10%. Yeah. So it was a good decision, and a good decision in that you all supported that as well.
Senator Girard.
Thank you. Actually, one of the questions got answered. The other one that just came to mind, the 50 years residency, does that have to be continuous, or is it?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, and Senator Drudd, no. The current statute reads that you had to live in the state for 50 years. It could have been the first 50 years of your life, or it could have been 50 years anywhere in those 65. It does not have to be continuous, and it doesn't have to be the last 50 years. And then lastly, I would just point out that we don't certify. People self-certify.
Oh, okay.
We have no way of confirming whether someone actually lived here. Whether they actually lived here for 50 years out of those 65 years or not. So
the follow-up, and you just sort of answered it, but what I was trying to protect is the military personnel that still use this as their residency, but they might be stationed in Germany or something like that. So if they used Oregon as their residency, then I would assume they would qualify.
Yeah, it counts. But again, it is the honor system. It's self-certification.
Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you go back to the previous slide, the new 6-year fee cycle. I'm looking, what was the rationale on the, I'm assuming angling tag is salmon steelhead tag, right? What was the rationale for the increase? It goes, it's almost doubled from what it was in 2010. And then if you go to the next slide, fishing was down like 1%. What was the rationale for that increase over the others?
Sure. Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, and Representative Lewis. When we structured, essentially, we were trying to minimize fee-related barriers to our customers who are on the margins. So entry-level anglers tend not to buy a salmon steelhead tag. Some do, but in general, they tend not to buy a salmon steelhead tag. So we were, and then, of course, our salmon and steelhead fisheries are the most expensive, both in terms of hatchery production costs, but also management costs. So we were trying to be strategic. We didn't just go across the board with an increase. We tried to increase our ability to recruit folks who are essentially entry level and charge the higher fees for the folks who are beyond entry level. And then your second question, Representative, was with regard to the decrease in resident license sales as shown on this table. I think, you know, we saw a decrease in combination licenses. We saw a decrease in resident anglers, slight decreases. But we also saw increases in Pioneer license holders. So some of these folks, a lot of people qualify every year for the Pioneer that did not qualify prior. You'll see that folks shifted to the sports pack. So some people were, it looks like, value shopping on the sports pack. And I'm speculating here, but I think there's some shifting going on. People don't buy the same product every year. They literally, I think in many cases, they value shop depending on their personal situation, what they plan to do for the year, whether they're employed or unemployed, moving on then, I want to show our resident and non-resident hunting license sales over the last little over a decade. And you'll see here really a remarkable and dramatic increase in the 2016 sales. That is, in the business world, they would explain this to you as a shift in accounting processes, I guess. And that, as I mentioned, prior to 2016, the Pioneer licenses were free, so they were not reflected in this infographic. Also, prior to 2016, our youth license was a split license. It was, you bought a fishing license and or you bought a hunting license. In 2016, we lowered the cost of that product and made it a combination license. So there are some accounting shifts that went on, if you will. Those are real sales, though, but there are accounting shifts that lead to that dramatic increase. If you look at it without those new products, those new license products, we saw a modest increase in the 2-3% range.
Representative Esquivel.
Real brief. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You usually get a decrease in licenses when you raise a fee. Is this just an anomaly, or has this happened before where we have an increase? That's very unusual.
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, and Representative Esquivel, it is very unusual. And it's we think there's I'll this is somewhat speculation, but since you ask, I'll tell you what I think. I think the combination of the stepped increase in the fees, which made it a much softer increase than in prior years, combined with we had some pretty good fishing opportunities, combined with the extremely low price or relatively low price of fuel, and then throw on top of that the fact that these do include those new license categories, the Pioneer license, which we're now charging for, as well as the expanded youth license. I think all those factors contributed to the increase. But you are absolutely correct, Representative. Across the country, when you increase fees, you almost always see a decline, a modest decline in sales.
Thank you.
It's very similar graphic on the fishing side, non-resident anglers and resident anglers. Again, seeing that increase in 2016 for the, I believe, the same, many of the same reasons that we discussed on the hunting graphic. And then looking forward, I want to talk with you a little bit. The agency's been involved in some strategic planning, and we've fleshed out this high level piece, but we're moving on with really some the implementation side, some strategies and tactics to implement these. But so this graphic really just shows at a high level our agency mission: protect and enhance Oregon's fish and wildlife and their habitats, recent enjoyment of present and future generations. Our agency executive leadership team's vision, which is the ODFW, is a recognized steward of Oregon's fish and wildlife resources with diversified funding that supports our mission. And then four underlying agency goals. I'm not going to go through all these in a whole lot of detail, but they all really drive towards the bottom line there on the chart, which is our big audacious goal, if you will, is to put this agency in a position that we do not need a fee increase in 2021, and hopefully that we can be in a position to actually reduce fees in 2019. Or if not reduce fees in 2019, then invest in other program enhancements. I can see how much time I have taken up here. Sorry, Mr. Chair. So looking forward, just this graphic really just shows our agency budget, or agency revenue, I should say, shows that essentially half of our agency revenue comes from hunters and anglers. A solid third or so, just under a third, comes from federal funds, 8% of our budget from general fund and lottery, and then 17% is obligated. These are funds that aren't fungible.
Senator Girard?
Yeah, Kurt, you sort of answered it before, but the federal funds are directly tied to the fishing licenses. Is that not correct?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, Senator Drodd, no. Oh. In fact, if you look at this graphic, the green wedge, which is there on the left-hand side, is tied to the fishing license and hunting license sales. So those are the federal excise tax revenues that come back to the state. That's a combined wedge that shows both fish and wildlife restoration dollars that come back. The larger purple federal fund wedge is a combination. It's mostly contract and mitigation obligations where the federal government has hired us or is paying us to either operate a fish hatchery or conduct a research program.
Co-Chair Frederick, did you have something? Were you just trying to get my attention?
I was getting your attention for you.
Okay, thank you.
As we develop our budget every 2 years, which we actually started developing this budget about a year and a half ago, I think it was, we have a standing external budget advisory committee that assists us. A number of those members are in the audience here today. I would like to thank them for their help. That EBAC, External Budget Advisory Committee, is made up of over 50 individuals that provide feedback. We held two meetings with them as we developed our budget. Then we had a roadshow where I went around the state to a series of 9 town hall meetings, again, to take public comment and deliver our budget proposals. And then, of course, we take written comments. And then additionally, not as part of our budget development process, but actually as part of the Alternative Funding Task Force, as they were going through their discussions, they wanted to have a better understanding of what the public at large thinks of ODFW. And so they actually commissioned a public opinion survey of Oregonians. We have this information linked on our website. I'm not going to go into a lot of details because there's literally hundreds of tabular tabs I could show on this. But the statewide, there's a statistically valid public opinion survey conducted. For us, some interesting results. Generally speaking, satisfaction with the department programs was high, That is 65% were satisfied, with 12% indicating they were dissatisfied. Availability of fish and wildlife-related recreational opportunities, a full 81% of respondents felt that it was excellent or good. And then the last bullet, and like I say, there's many, many other pieces of information in the survey, but 88% of respondents felt that the department was credible or very credible. Want to move on now to the department's, the governor's recommended budget. For us, this is largely a current service level budget with a few enhancements, a few policy option packages. You'll see that general fund in the governor's budget is approximately a 10% reduction from our 15-17 general fund. The lottery funds essentially flat at 1% of the agency budget. Other funds, which are licensed dollars and other non-federal dollars, at about 52% of the agency budget, or about $194 million. And federal funds at 39% of the agency budget at just under $148 million. This chart really is just to show you the nature of the revenue across the two biennia. So 15-17 budget is on the left. The 17-19 budget is on the right. I would point to the beginning balance. These are all funds beginning balance. On the left, you'll see that in the 15-17 budget cycle, we had a beginning balance of $23 million. That includes dedicated and obligated, as well as licensed revenue. And we're now at just under $43 million beginning fund balance, all fund types. Expenditures, we got several different pie charts here to show expenditures, but really not much change across the two biennia. As I said, it's current service level budget, so essentially 50 or just over 50% in other fund expenditures, 39% in federal funds and 8% general fund. Expenditures by program, really just to show the magnitude of our fish program. The three green wedges on the right are fish related program, and they make up in excess of 50% of the agency budget. If you look at the wildlife management and habitat resources, it's only about 20% of the agency budget. Want to talk very briefly about the DAS budget analysts 090 package, which are the reduction packages. I do have Kathy here if there's questions on this, but basically just under $3 million in general fund reduction. There was not a corresponding reduction in program in that several of those were fund shifted. So some of the general fund that we had in hatcheries was fund shifted onto license dollars. And then there was elimination or reduction in the general fund support for government service charges, and those were backfilled with other fund revenue as well. And then Measure 76 lottery fund revenue reduction, which is just to match the current service level expenditures. And lastly, we do have an other fund license fund reduction where a position is being moved from ODFW to the Oregon State Chief Information Office. So the position is being moved along with the revenue to support the position.
Senator Girard.
Again, sorry if you went over this, but I missed it. The actual hatchery output, are you trying to maintain current levels of hatchery output, or are you trying to reduce it?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, and Senator Girard, no, we are not reducing any hatchery production in the governor's recommended budget. So at a very high level, we do have a number of policy option packages, 16 to be precise. Out of those 16, 11 are continuations from the 15-17 budget process. There are five new ones, and you'll hear a little bit some of the details as we get into the fish division and the wildlife division or the administrative division's budget overview. And one of those pops we'll also talk about here in a little bit is related to the state police. So state police, as I mentioned, we do fund state police. I believe we currently in the 17-19 budget, I believe we're proposing to transfer about $24 million of other fund license or commercial fish fund or shellfish fund to the state police Fish and Wildlife Division for their enforcement efforts. We do have a dash line to them. They're even though they aren't part of the agency formally, they are certainly part of the agency executive team. They participate in all of our executive leadership team activities. Their leadership does, and we work very closely together.
I think we're good.
Like ODFW, they have workstations, offices across the state to closer to the resources upon which they serve. They have 120 sworn officers statewide.
Representative Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair. I don't know if I'm getting ahead of myself here, but I would like your thoughts on whether, at some point, whether our capabilities based on our budget and interaction with OSP is sufficient to allow them to do the job that we want them to do out on the ground. And Mr. Director, you know how concerned I am with poaching in this state. And when, based on who you talk with, and hunters in particular and fishermen that know, there are estimates out there, maybe they're back of pocket, but that we're losing about 50% of our fish and wildlife a year to poaching compared, as much of a take, illegal take is occurring as legal take. Now, that may be a little bit exaggerated, but I think you know where I'm going with that. And how do we make sure that we are actually combating poaching in the most effective way, with maybe not even with what we got, but what we actually need?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, and Representative Helm, we could probably talk about that for the better part of this day and tomorrow. I think, you know, at 120 troopers statewide, that's pretty much where they've been. They've been in the 119 troopers statewide for several decades. We can get you the exact history on that, but that's pretty much their where they've been funded for a number of years. No one would ever tell you that it's fully adequate. I mean, this is a big state, and 120 troopers to cover the entire state is not a lot. And where a lot of this activity occurs is not in neighborhoods, or you know, there's not hundreds or even dozens or even pairs of witnesses necessarily available. So, you know, certainly, I think everyone would tell you that we would support more fish and wildlife enforcement. The real, you know, the difficulty is how to pay for it. And I mean, I know the Alternative Funding Task Force, when they met, they had part of their recommendation included some additional troopers for fish and wildlife enforcement work. I think about half of the Fish and Wildlife Division's funding is essentially general fund, or at least non-ODFW. We pay a little over half. Mm-hmm. The balance is from other sources, and we think general fund support is appropriate. Fish and wildlife belong to all. It's a trust resource that's held on behalf of all residents, not just people who fish and hunt. And lots of the work that they do is not related to fishing and hunting. It's investigating the bald eagle that gets killed, or which has nothing to do with legitimate hunting. So. I would never tell you that it's adequate.
Thank you. That's the answer I'm looking for.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kurt, when back in the 70s, we had almost 700 troopers in the state of Oregon, 680 or something like that. Today, we currently have about 340, which means that we've dropped that in half almost,
and are pretty much in half, and yet the population certainly hasn't remained the same as it was in 1976. Did we do the same thing with the troopers on Fish and Wildlife?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, and Representative Asquall, I don't believe so. I believe if you look at the, and we can get this for you in follow-up or offline, but I think if you look, the 119 troopers is pretty, it's been that way for many decades. So they did not, the Fish and Wildlife enforcement did not suffer the same decline, if you will, that the patrol side did as funding came into, as things got difficult on the funding side. But we can verify that for you, since I'm...
Well, that's fine, but what I'm getting at here is that if it was in 1976 is 119, today it's 120, there's something wrong with that picture as well, because the population certainly hasn't stayed the same. And, of course, we have poaching, in my opinion, that's running amok in this state. So I would, yeah, we have a problem. Thank you.
We do have a policy option package related to state police. We do have, we're requesting $100,000 in other fund to create an overtime pool. And this is to, in order for them to do some enhanced enforcement on, at key winter range sites where we know we have poaching that's going on, or at least targeted mature buck related poaching going on. So $100,000 overtime pool for that. Which then I think brings me to the next segment of our presentation. I'm going to hand it off to Cameron Smith here, unless there's any questions here on the ODFW overview.
Director Melcher, a couple of questions here. Are we better off paying overtime, or would we be better off adding another few positions, one or two?
Yeah, Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, that's a great question. I think from our perspective, each trooper costs about $300,000 per biennium.
Okay.
So with a $100,000 overtime pool, you get a third of a trooper.
Yes.
Whereas when you have these troopers on the ground and they've already traveled 2 hours to the site, it's much cheaper to pay them to stay an extra 3 hours. I'm making that up, but than it is to have a trooper that's one third time trooper.
Thank you. That's very helpful. And then early on in your presentation, you mentioned that you've eliminated 46 positions. How many of those were filled at the time of elimination?
Sure. Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick. The 46 positions that were eliminated, I believe it was 36 of them had employees in them. Oh. And we started this budget development process for the biennium we're in right now. We started that process in early 2014. And as we saw the nature of our gap at the time, we really got aggressive in that we started holding all positions vacant within the agency. And when positions, we had a 4-month mandatory vacancy hold on all positions, and then when positions were filled, unless there was a recruitment failure where there were no qualified applicants, we were filling positions solely from within the agency, which created two things. It maximized the probability that we would have vacancies for the targeted staff to be able to transfer into, and it also created the cascading effect of creating additional vacancies over time. And so we, out of those 36 positions that were occupied, we only initiated one layoff, and that individual actually had some opportunities. We had a couple of positions that she could have gone into, but she elected to go a different direction. So we did not, with that one exception, did not have to lay off any employees.
Sounds like a very humane approach. Thank you for that. Anyone else? Thank you.
Okay.
Co-Chairs Witt and Fredericks, excuse me, Cameron Smith, the Interim Deputy Director for Administration. There's five sections within the administrative programs, administrative services, information and education, human resources, our information services, and our newest division, which is management resources. Administrative services, this is one of the things that we have, I think that maybe some agencies don't have, is this has the program that helps sell our license. As you can see, we have to support 500 point of sale vendors. These are, you know, the vendors in Bi-Mart and, you know, Dick's Sporting Goods, that type of a deal. It also has our accounting functions and also our contracting functions. Again, we have not only outgoing contracts but incoming contracts, revenue contracts, grants, and those are about 900, as you can see, annually with our grants and contracts. But those are all the contracts that bring in that federal revenue as well as some other revenues. And then also in this section we have our accounts payable and payroll services, pretty much the functions that you would expect to see in an administrative services program. And then we also have human services, which supports, you know, does the general human services role. Again, that we are much more of an outdoor type of work environment. Work workforce and safety is one of our important roles. But also what we're trying to implement also here with a lot of the hiring that we do is automation, and that's where the bottom bullet is about, which is interview stream. This is a software that we can actually put out there with questions, and then applicants actually respond in video format and then post it back to us. And that way we can actually see videos of more of our applicants. So it broadens the pool for us as far as looking to hire. So that's part of the automation that we're trying to help us improve our workforce. Information services. This is our our networking, maintaining our personal computers and our software application development. And then we have our information and education section, which is again a little different than some because the education side of this is our hunter safety programs, our angler safety programs, but also we try to provide a lot of information out there. A lot of people want to know where to hunt, where to fish, when and how, because, you know, especially with some of our fisheries, they're managed more by temporary rules sometimes. So we have to make sure, notify people and have ways that people can read and find out where they can fish and when. And also trying to encourage people to fish, you know, and try to show them places to fish to try to, again, this is to build up the outdoor recreation. And we try to work here with, you know, automation of, you know, on internet campaigns and internet outreach. What I'd like to talk a little bit about here is in administration, we are working on trying to automate more and more a lot of the data as a way to improve cost savings and our efficiencies. One of the things after this slide we'll talk about is the online task tracking information system, which is the impetus was behind that was HB 3315. Outcome-based management, that's where we're trying to work with performance measures and try to identify weaknesses and improve where we can make more efficient operations within our processes. We've created and hired an internal auditor to review and make sure that, you know, our processes are safe. This is one of the things that the Secretary of State also wanted us to have. And we have also established our latest division, which is Management Resources, and this is a division that's trying to help centralize some functions to where management can, you know, managers throughout the department can know where to go to kind of help get some services that they need to help their programs run more efficiently. Some of the technology that we're using is GoToMeetings, I think.
Senator Girard.
Yeah, I actually wanted to back you up a slide and kind of throw you a bone. I use the stocking schedules that you put out.
secret to good trout fishing is following the trout, the hatchery truck sometimes. And,
yep.
And so I use that a fair amount, that and ospreys. But,
an idea for you.
Well, for Tom
Wolf. I just wanted to throw you a kudo. I think a lot of people find that very useful.
Thank you.
If you don't,
Coach here, Frederick.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I wanted to go in another direction, if possible. One of the things I'm constantly talking about is the fact that I've seen fewer hunters and fishing people in my district. And I'm north and northeast Portland. So there are fewer people who are going out and fishing. Your education system is appropriately targeting hunting and fishing because you're looking at licenses. But it's also talking about getting the folks who are involved in habitat, et cetera. And there are a lot of people in my district who are involved in habitat and concerned. I'm curious about how you are, what your communication strategy is to get to those folks, because they are not necessarily out there to consume, to bring back a fish or fowl or something like that, but they are, in fact, out there a lot, exercising and enjoying themselves because of the way that you've managed the system. So I'm just curious about what you have in terms of communication with that particular group.
We're working on trying to update our internet web pages a little bit to try to help point out places, wildlife viewing and that type of thing, and also even places to go within certain distances of cities. One of the things I'd like to point out is we actually have created like a statewide volunteer coordinator, and what we want to do is actually try to work with the general public to help volunteer to do certain types of work like habitat restoration and that thing, a type of work, and also we're preparing to buy some software that would go again on the web to provide this information out there, things to do, and ways they can help. But right now it's mainly an information outreach. We have a face page, where we try to post information and respond to people's requests for information.
Oh, I appreciate that. We may want to talk a little later on about some other possibilities there.
We'd be more than happy.
Yeah. Thanks, Mr. Co-Chair and Co-Chair Frederick. I'd love to talk to you about that. I think for us, that's one of the tough nuts to crack, if you will, in that our fishing and hunting customers, we know who every one of them is. They're in our database. We can contact them. We're using modern technology to do that. When it comes to the general public, we don't necessarily have that, the non-fishing or non-hunting public. We are using new media platforms, though, extensively. We actually have a social media coordinator, as Cameron mentioned. We're on Twitter. We're on Twitter not just with the fishing and hunting type tweets, but we also have conservation-related Twitter account and Facebook account. So we are using those new media. We're doing Snapchat. For anybody who knows what that is, I don't, but I mean, I do. But anyway, we would love to talk with you about that. And we are, we're working with some of the urban fishing communities, NODR. I'm not sure if you're familiar with them, but we've actually been partnering with them on some. Of course, that's fishing related, but still, it's communities that we want to be able to reach and serve.
Thank you. Well, I was just curious about that. Thank you.
The department's not the only ones that knows who we are, and have lots of information about us. About a year ago, while I was waiting for the return of my lottery results, I got a letter in the mail, and I thought, oh boy, this is it. I'm finally getting that sheep tag. And I got a notice that I was one of the lucky thousands whose data was breached by one of our vendors. Can you tell me what precautions the department takes to make sure that our most personal data is not breached and whether or not we have any concern that we hire less than secure vendors simply because they're the low bidder on a government contract?
Yeah. Coach Erwitt, thanks for that question. And I, too, was one of those people who got the letter because
congratulations.
I, too, am in the
database. Congratulations. It's a great feeling,
there
isn't
was,
it?
There was 1.1 million of us, actually.
Yeah.
That was, of course, a vendor's website. It wasn't something that the vendor did to get into our data. It was actually a vendor's website.
Right.
We were fortunate in that our data that's in the vendor's website did not include Social Security numbers.
Mm.
That is not the case in Idaho. Idaho had the same breach. Washington had the same breach. They had Social Security numbers. In our case, the only personally identifiable information that was accessed was your driver's license number. We are actually right now in the process of, we've been looking at the business need, and there is some loss in terms of enforcement ability to see the driver's license number on your hunting license, but we're right now in the process of eliminating that field, which will essentially, if that had happened a year ago, would have essentially made us not part of the breach. So,
and were all these data breaches with the same vendor?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, Idaho, Washington, and Oregon were all using the same point of sale license vendor. Idaho has Washington has already changed vendors. They were in the request for proposals process, and they've actually issued a contract, and they're with a new vendor now. Idaho is on the verge of doing that. They had a request for proposals out last year, and I'm not sure if they've actually accepted a new proposal, and it may be the same company. I don't know who's going to ultimately get the bid. And then we're a couple years out, but we're actually in the process as well. Our current contract with that vendor expires in a couple years, and so we're starting now. We've actually have one of our staff folks as a project manager to go and seek alternatives, both, and low cost is not this, it's not just a simple low cost bid, it's a best value proposition.
And so in the interim, the two, now I guess going on 3 years by the time you get to the new contract, what steps have been taken to make sure that these kind of breaches don't reoccur with this vendor who appears incapable of preventing it region-wide?
Sure. Co-Chair Witt, we've worked extensively with the state CIO's office, and they have done a number of scans on the vendor's site and software. So we're pretty comfortable right now, and we wouldn't have gone live with the system if we weren't comfortable that it had been addressed. But having said that, you know, there's, not to sound flippant, but they say there's two entities out there, those that have been hacked and those that don't know it.
Yeah.
And so there's always some risk in these systems.
Thank you. Yeah. Anyone else?
Okay.
Now I'd like to go on to the online task tracking information system. Again, this was the impetus of this was the House Bill 3315, which was to try to help us recoup some costs or identify the possibility of recouping costs from other state agencies who have asked for our help or asked for us to review certain types of information on some of their processes that they have when they actually have permits that they must issue that affect wildlife. We capture the data in a group, and that's a work group. It's not a person group. It's type of work that's done. So that's, you know, the high level of which we've decided to capture this group, and then below that we identify the activity that it is being done, and we can actually identify the species as that work is going to. We've just implemented this. In fact, we're getting ready, hopefully this week, to send out, one part of the bill was to send out notices to the agencies if we were billing them, how much their bill would be. Or their charges would be. But right now, we're still in the implementation phase of that. Those staff that are using the system right now are mainly district staff, which is our district biologists and our assistant district biologists, although we're just, again, now moving to expand this to the Marine Resources Program to have them start reporting on this, habitat biologists and staff biologists. Some of the staff that aren't using this system would be like the hatchery staff, because, you know, they're working totally on hatcheries, and administrative staff. Right now, we have over 54,000 hours in our database. Let me actually go to the next slide, which is a big pie, which we've broken down into what we call here. 84% of that is ODFW type of work, and the other 16% is really not related to ODFW. Of that 16%, 5 of that is with working with other state agencies. And for the first 6 months, we would have about 205 billable hours that, you know, we could theoretically charge. We're not, you know, under the bill, we don't charge this biennium. And we wouldn't charge all the other smaller pieces of pie, the local governments, the tribes, or education. We can't charge that. We under the bill and have no intent. And then the federal government, that is the other portion of that 16%. There, you know, almost half of it, 7%. And this is work that we have, you know, we still perform with other, you know, the federal agencies that we aren't getting reimbursed for. Some of the top, you know, major agencies here is Fish and Wildlife, Forest Service, and Department of Ag.
And Mr. Chair, if I could add, I don't want to focus too much on the details here. We're really in the first quarter that we've been implementing this, but down the road, this is going to be a really powerful tool for us to look at where and how our resources are being allocated, and also it's going to be a powerful tool to tell our story, and with actual empirical data, not just anecdote. And so we've expanded the House Bill 3315 piece, which was just we were going to track our ability, you know, our hours that we were able to bill, but we've expanded that to really be much more global and tracking, so that over time it's going to be a powerful tool for us, and I'm really excited about it.
Excellent.
Going on again, this is showing, you know, by breaking out those groups again, about of those that are reporting in the system now, this shows you where most of their work is being done. You know, 29% in wildlife, 18% in fish, 29% in administration, and 11% in customer service. That's out helping people who call in with issues. Again, I wasn't going to go into too much detail on this. And then it's showing again, this is just on the wildlife side, the activity that we can, type of activity we're tracking, you know, whether it be for surveys, for research, for, you know, how much time they're spending on wildlife damage type of work, wildlife management. And then, you know, there's, you know, dealing with sick, injured, diseased animals, nuisance, which is basically your smaller animals like skunks, raccoons, when people call on that. And then, like, public safety, that is when we actually have to deal with maybe a cougar in a city somewhere or whatever, you know, when someone calls on those and points out there's a cougar in a tree or something. And then on this is on the fish side, again, fish surveys, fish management. And a large, you know, one that they have here is screens and passage. There's a lot of work done there. So, you know, that was pretty much it on the task tracking. And then we do have two POPs I'd like to talk about. These are actually capital POPs. First one is capital improvements. We need to replace the roof at our headquarters building, and that's what this is asking for. There are some leaks that we've had to patch, and we just need to replace it. So we're asking for roughly $500,000 for that. And then this is the our big pop, you know, request period. But we are trying want to identify our deferred maintenance, and start working on trying to reduce that deferred maintenance. And this would be we're asking for $10 million, and it'd be funded by debt service general bond fund.
Representative Esquivel?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. How's the building you're in? It's not very old, is it?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, and Representative Esquivel, it's about 20 years old. Flat roof, it's near end of life, and we had hoped to get a few more years out of it, but the experts are telling us that that's not a good plan to try and get a few more years out of it. And so we don't want this to become another one of our deferred maintenance problems.
As I say, I always say to this committee, it seems like every department that comes in here has deferred maintenance that they've never taken care of.
We're trying, sir, we're trying to avoid that.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And Mr. Director, you and I have talked a little bit about the backlog of maintenance, especially on hatcheries. Has there ever been any analysis or prioritization of the work that might go on at some of our hatcheries in comparison to their age and their current situation and the need for maintenance?
Sure, Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, and Representative Helm. We do have, about a decade ago, perhaps a little over a decade ago, we did an extensive deferred maintenance report. Actually had a contractor that did that report. The Department of Administrative Services is currently in a larger deferred maintenance review, which we are a part of. We know we have certainly in excess of $10 million worth of deferred maintenance, perhaps 10 times that if you really get right down to it. But we have had our engineering staff actually looking at projects that would be the highest priority. Our facilities right now, the hatcheries in particular, which I think is what you're most interested in, are all for us part of our future business plan, and we barring some unforeseen event, we have no intent to be closing any of those facilities. When obviously we don't want to be spending deferred maintenance dollars on a facility if the department was going to be recommending closing it in a few years or in the out years. But at this point, we don't have any facilities that are currently producing fish that we would identify as being on a list to eliminate or reduce.
That follow-up?
Please.
Would that information be information that we can have?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, and Representative Helm, absolutely. If we can provide you, I'm not sure if we have it for you tomorrow or not, but we can certainly provide you with a list of the projects, what we consider right now to be our highest priority, which would account for this $10 million. So, yeah, absolutely.
I might
even be able to have it tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Director. Yeah, I would like to have that. For the whole committee, please.
Will do.
Representative Esquivel? Well,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the point I was trying to make, Director Melcher, was why aren't we maintaining these facilities as we go along instead of waiting until the building's on fire and then call the fire department?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, and Representative Esquivel, largely it's been revenue-driven. It's been prior decisions have been made to prioritize other programs over deferred maintenance. And I think we're not unique in that, that's how those decisions get made, but that's really comes down to resources and prioritizing resources away from deferred maintenance or maintenance activities.
Follow up.
Please.
So this body has told you to ignore your maintenance and do something different?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, and Representative Esquivel, I don't know that ignore is the appropriate word, but there's certainly, I think there's certainly a focus on maintaining programs and I'll give you an extreme example. When we're talking at essentially revenue neutral decision So it's kind of net zero decision making. If we need $1 million to maintain, do maintenance projects at two hatcheries, and the choice is to spend, close one hatchery to raise the revenue to do the maintenance at the two hatcheries, that's not a decision. It's not in our long-term interest to close the facility. So we've been limping along. We've certainly been doing deferred maintenance or maintenance work at all of these facilities, just not at the level that that we think is in our long-term interest.
Well, I have to believe, Kurt, that when you began your presentation, you talked about declining income and that sort of thing. And I have to believe that during the period of the Great Recession, you were probably having to defer a lot more than anyone would ever choose to have to do if they had their choice. So it's time to pay the bill now. So thank you. That's helpful.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Esquivel.
I'd like to find a way where we fund these facilities and what wants to be accomplished in the state of Oregon so everyone in this state pays. But I don't want to frivolously take the money and start hiring a bunch of people for a cause that we don't even know really what the cause is. That's why I've asked you for your department to bring me a list of what the biologists, we have over 430 biologists, I believe. Isn't that pretty close?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, and Representative Esquivel, I believe it's 403.
Sorry, I misunderstood then. But I would like to know exactly what they've been doing, exactly what they've been working on, how long they've been working on it, and what the outcome is. So, and that's how we have to evaluate things, I think. So, but I mean, I want to have everyone in the state pay for the wildlife because it belongs to everyone in the state.
Brad.
Senator Girard.
Yeah, Kurt, you might not have this, but in a couple slides ahead of this, you talk about the number of FTEs and how much the agency spends. The question I've asked all agencies is what your cost is per FTE, and you might break it down per division so that we can see how much we're paying for the average staff member in ODF&W.
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, and Senator Girard, cost per FTE with the OPE, the roll-up, or just the salary?
Just salary.
Okay. I think, Cameron, we probably have that right out of our picks. Anyway, we can figure that out.
Yeah. I'll wait two more slides, and you're going to be there, but you don't. Maybe we can discuss it then, but if you run the numbers, it doesn't come out what the average salary is. So there's something else in the $77 million that you're spending versus the 211 FTEs that you have in the Wildlife Division. So.
Okay. All right. Well, that concludes the administration and the department overview. We're going to have Dr. Doug Cottom come up to make the Wildlife Division presentation and at least start it. Perhaps we'll be able to finish it today. Dr. Cottom has recently replaced Ron Anglin, who many of you probably knew. Ron retired in December, and so we hired Doug in, I believe he started in January, as the Wildlife Division Administrator. So thank you.
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Cottom. I'm the Wildlife Division Administrator for the department. I'm going to talk about some of the details and the programs and the purpose of the Wildlife Division and the services that we provide to the public, including wildlife, habitat, conservation, management. We also provide a lot of technical assistance to the public on things like involving wildlife management and wildlife conflict resolution. This is how the Wildlife Division is organized. We have three main programs within the division. That's wildlife management, habitat resources, and conservation. These three programs are integrated with one with each other. The budget is approximately $77 million. We have 216 positions, 211.28 FTEs. I'm going to go into each of the programs and what they do. For the wildlife management program, the purpose of the missing a slide there.
Well, you just get to wing it then.
Okay. Well, okay, the purpose of the wildlife management program is it's our largest program. It's multi-purpose. We work on things like species management, damage, habitat improvement, hunting seasons, wildlife areas, research, and wildlife health. I'll get into each one of them a little more detail. The funding is predominantly license funds, followed by federal funds, and about $3.1 million in general fund. The operations program is actually really integrated within the three main programs. The operations program includes the division administration. We have an operations manager, wildlife area coordinator. We have a grants coordinator, a cultural resource specialist, which is something akin to an archaeologist. And we have support staff. For example, some of the support staff are administrative rules coordinators. The operations folks provide budgeting support for our wildlife areas and our field staff, as well as other support. Wow. And we work closely with our Fish and Wildlife Commission and conduct legislative tasks. Our wildlife management program itself, like I mentioned, I think I already really kind of talked about the slide a little bit. And I'm going to go into more detail. I've got my pages mixed up a little bit. Mm-hmm. All right. Hunting is one of the main functions. Hunting season management is one of the main functions of our wildlife management program. We, as you saw earlier, hunting provides, it's very important to the economy of the state of Oregon, both for the recreational opportunity that we provide, as well as the reduction in damage to property and agricultural crops. Our field biologists collect a lot of data on our hunted species and work with our headquarters staff to work on future hunting seasons, proposals, tag numbers, all sorts of things like that. The hunting seasons involves a lot of public involvement. We have meetings throughout the state within all of our wildlife districts, and we work closely with our sport hunting groups, such as the Oregon Hunters Association, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, constantly involving them in planning for our hunting seasons. We also have an access and habitat program, which is a $4 surcharge on hunting licenses. That program provides funding for habitat improvement projects and hunting access, in particular to private lands, which is also a large benefit to our hunting seasons and our hunting public. We, our field staff spends a lot of time working on wildlife conflict resolution. We have, if on that our online time tracking information system so far, it looks like around 25% of our field staff's time is spent on damage. Damage is really particularly focused around elk, bears, and deer. It depends on what part of the state that you actually live in. We do have a wildlife damage policy, which is a step-by-step guide for our field staff to address wildlife damage. And typically starts out with non-lethal solutions. We do receive a lot of nuisance complaints and occasionally human safety-related complaints from wildlife, and they usually require a lot of advice and education with the public to try to help them live with wildlife. And those are most of our nuisance complaints will come from fairly urban, rural residential areas. One of the issues that generates a lot of nuisance complaints is wildlife feeding. It's a very difficult subject that our folks work on because most people who are feeding wildlife are kind-hearted and good-natured, and they think they're doing a good thing, but oftentimes it causes a lot of problems, especially with their neighbors. And then sometimes it causes wildlife health issues as well.
The question I have is, you have a picture of Canadian geese in a field, and we all know that we have more Canadian geese than we could ever deal with, and that has to do with the dusky. Is there anything that we can, I know you're trying to do identification programs. What can we do to promote hunting of Canadian geese in a safe manner, not to harm the dusky?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, Senator Girard. One of the things that we are trying to do, and I'll talk about it a little bit later, are things like our open fields program, which is an effort to help farmers allow more public hunting on their property. It is one of the big issues that we have to deal with in the Willamette Valley is that so much public, so much private property, where many landowners have a difficult time allowing hunting to occur on their property for a variety of reasons. And so that's, I'll talk about a little bit more.
Follow up, if I could.
Please.
I know, don't you have hunting educational courses that you have to go through in order to get a permit to, what I'm trying to do is to make it easier for the hunter, because most people just don't want to go get the darn permit. So what do you got?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, and Senator Rudd, you're absolutely correct. So in the Northwest Oregon, not to steal Doug's thunder here, but in the Northwest Oregon permit goose area, we do, because of the dusky Canada goose, which are a candidate species under the Federal Endangered Species Act, and our intense need and desire to not have those geese harvested, while at the same time focusing harvest on these large, abundant, mostly cackling Canada geese populations, we have an identification program. So hunters have to take the test so that they can identify, that at least they've been exposed and hopefully can identify visually, without measuring their bill length, the
which is hard
species
to do when they're flying,
because you can't do it when they're flying, exactly. But one of the primary barriers has been the need to operate check stations. And so over the last 20 years, as we expanded this hunting opportunity, we had to provide check stations, and hunters literally had to check out at the check stations. Over time, we've actually been able to eliminate the check stations. So we have eliminated at least that one barrier to participation. You know, the need for someone from Silverton to have to drive to West Salem to go to the check station. I mean, I'm making that up. I don't know what the real, but there are sometimes many great distances. So we have addressed the check station issue as a barrier. Highly unlikely, unless dusky Canada geese are recovered, which right now doesn't look to happen anytime soon, highly unlikely that we'll ever be able to eliminate the need for the educational component. But then the other factor, and Doug pointed out, is really, this is almost all private land damage, and the ability to have a significant number of folks hunting on those private lands, not just on the one little patch, but across the landscape, is really important, and we're working on that still.
Final question, Representative Esquivel, very quickly.
Mr. Chair, I'll wait until tomorrow when we get back in here, because I have two questions, and it may take a little while to answer.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen, appreciate it. We've run out of time. I am going to adjourn the public hearing today on House Bill 5010 and adjourn the committee. Thank you very much. Committee, thank you very much. And adjourn the committee.